I just want to say, first thing, that the people on the panel were assigned various positions, and they made wander off from these positions. I mean, because they're not people who are sort of comfortable with easy positions, with clear, simple positions. So if that happens, they should be forgiven. The first speaker is going to be Christian Lotz, who's going to talk about Adorno, explain Adorno. And we know he's qualified to do that because he wrote a book about Husserl, who's probably even harder than Adorno, I think. Maybe to me, he's harder than Adorno. And he wrote it, was published by a great press, by Paul Grave, which means he not only wrote a great book about Adorno, he wrote it in English, even though his native language is German. So, Christian's going to start, I guess.
All right. I think the task was not, so to speak, that we give full lectures here. So I just want to talk briefly a little bit about the background of Adorno's text and then outline a couple of issues that are mentioned in it. And then I think we should go on so that you have enough time for your questions and maybe for some discussions that we might have about Adorno. Now, I was asked to defend Adorno, and so I don't want to go so far, I think, simply by clarifying some issues and by taking them on in some kind of affirmative fashion. It should be clear that I do not believe that sort of Adorno's analysis is outdated or basically false or wrong. As you can hear, I am German, so I was able to read The Dialectic of Enlightenment in German, and it's kind of interesting because the book was the first book I ever read in the university. So most of my classes that I took when I went to German university were sort of like book classes, so it's not so much overview classes as you have it here in the U.S., and sort of I took three seminars, I remember, in my first semester, and so two of the others were about other major philosophical books, and this one was the first one I was confronted with, so I'm happy that I can return sort of to my roots here and sort of to my shocking experience with a specific way of thinking about our contemporary world. I think just a couple of things about sort of the background. I think the most important thing that you should take into account is that Adorno was always sort of an outsider. He became first very central for the European and especially, of course, German intellectual culture after the Second World War, sort of in the 50s and 60s, when he was well established. And when he came back from the U.S., because, of course, through the Hitler regime in Germany, almost all Jewish intellectuals who sort of saw coming what was happening with Hitler were forced to immigrate. And some of you probably know that one of the most flourishing sort of intellectual communities was actually established at the West Coast in California around Los Angeles, where later Adorno also ended up working for a research institute. And I think this kind of experience of immigration is very important. You have to take into account that we have someone in front of us who was never anywhere at home, or let's say nowhere, anywhere really at home, because he was forced through external situations to move around in the world and basically to escape. Although later in his life he expressed several times that his return to Germany was sort of like a sort of homecoming. If you take this immigration experience into account, there's one important aspect that you should see. The book was written sort of during the last period of the Second World War in the 40s, and it came out in 1944 with actually only a few copies, so it became popular later. But there's one important aspect there, namely the experience in which the media and culture was picked up by the Hitler regime. I think a lot of sort of like maybe people outside of Europe are not fully aware that, of course, one strong force of the totalitarian regime of Hitler was a very rational and a very elaborated takeover of the media and culture system at that point in Germany. There is something that was called the Gleichschaltung, the evening out of the media right at the beginning when Hitler came to power, which basically meant that all the media were taken over by the state forces and by the state power. And if you see documentaries about the time, you can see that the Hitler regime had an extremely advanced inclusion of modern radio technology, modern film technology, and modern aesthetics. So you could see that there was the first time, actually something similar happened in Russia as well, but I think in Hitler it was sort of like much extremer, a total inclusion of the media and of general culture forces into a political system that of course was built upon totalitarian ideas, which meant that totalitarianism and the media and the culture in the end in Germany became almost one system, and therefore, of course, were able to unfold parts of its destructive force. So I think you should take that into account, because you have, so to speak, someone coming out who notices at the beginning of the 30s that that what we usually evaluate in a highly positive fashion, namely media and culture, somehow can become intermingled with a let's say, a political system. Now, if you imagine someone of these Europeans and someone who was extremely well-educated like Adorno and a writing machine every day and extremely intelligent, now moves into an American culture and experiences something weird, I think, on the other side, namely that person experiences a dealing with media and culture and advertisement and film almost in a similar fashion as it was done in Germany, but without, of course, the inclusion of the political totalitarian system, but noticing that it seemed to be that that media and culture system itself became, so to speak, intrinsically totalitarian. And I think that is one major thesis, of course, of the text, that something happened intrinsically with the media and the culture, namely it has sort of like shows the structure that was visible, especially in Germany at that point in connection with the political system. That's one aspect that you should take into account. The other aspect you should take into account is a very ambivalent relation towards Marxism. Now, it's very difficult because I don't know how much you know about it. I teach it actually in one of my IIH classes, so it always takes a while before some of you are getting sort of out of your used way of thinking about Marxism. But there's a very simple distinction in classical Marxism between the economic system and the ideological system, or the system through which the societies develop their ideas in science, in religion, in their cultural system, in their media system. And one of the major theses of the classical Marxism was that somehow these upper ideological systems in which we produce our awareness, our beliefs, our ideas, are somehow simply the reaction, the consequence of what happens at the economic reproduction of the society. So that sort of whenever, so to speak, the economic reality of the society is, let's say, not in order anymore, as of course the assumption was in Marxism with the capitalistic system, then we see, so to speak, an effect in the way in which we affirm and double that structure on the ideological level in which we produce the beliefs and ideas. And I think that changes at the beginning of the 20th century, and it becomes much more complex, because the thesis of Adorno and Horkheimer at that point is that the society does not only reproduce itself anymore through the economic system and thereby has consequences for the ideological systems, but rather that the societies reproduce themselves through the cultural and ideological systems, which means that the forces that in former times, let's say up to the 19th century, were sort of like marginal cases, universities, churches, the production of beliefs, and so on, that now suddenly becomes the essential factor, especially in science and culture and media, for the reproduction of the whole society. So I think you should also take that shift into account. That, of course, means that the capitalistic system now can not longer be analyzed simply on the basic level, so to speak, on the economic level and the social relations that it produces. That was already an idea in Marx, but rather the capitalistic system can itself be analyzed by analyzing the cultural system, which is now, so to speak, the major reproductive factor for the society as a whole. And the third thing I want to mention is the background of the whole book. Of course, you have only read one chapter, and the Dialectic of Enlightenment is a little bit larger, and the culture industry chapter is embedded within a larger theory of the historical process of mankind, and especially of the process of enlightenment. And one thesis of the book is that somehow the liberation from which the human project started out, namely liberating ourselves from the natural forces, from the environment, from all that what determines us from the outside, and that, so to speak, civilization is the constant liberation from those elements, right? So through the sciences, through our civilizatory process, we slowly sort of overcome our dependency on of nature, that somehow that turns around and it has, so to speak, always its negative effects, namely every move with which we try to liberate ourselves from the natural roots from which we come out somehow turn into destruction of our own nature and external nature, and sort of constantly producing effects that are the opposite of what was really intended by the civilizatory process, right? A simple example, that's the thesis. There were a couple of other philosophers who have dealt with that. We know that on the one hand we have all the modern sciences, and the modern sciences are, of course, there to emancipate us from our death, they are there to emancipate us from our finitude, they are there to emancipate us from nature, they are there to overcome all these catastrophes, and what do we produce? We produce basically an environmental destruction through the technological and scientific products that we have produced throughout the last 200 years, and we produce a psychological destruction of ourselves, and thereby we can, so to speak, see that every what looks like an advancement on one level is in the end just, so to speak, a further destruction within the civilizatory process, right? Or after the Second World War, the discussion about the atom bomb was the most visible example, because the atom bomb was the pure result of a mix of, let's say, industry and science, and suddenly we realize that the sciences are not longer this kind of ideal thing in which we all become free and sort of progress as human beings, but rather it leads to the opposite of it, namely it leads to the potential destruction of ourselves, which means sciences, ideology, culture, all these forces are now turning into the destructive, onto the destructive side of ourselves. So I think you should sort of like take that into account. So let me just say a couple of things about the opposite concept that you need if you want to fully understand the culture industry chapter, and I think it is very important to sort of think for a second of what is actually culture. What is that actually, right? They are calling the whole chapter the culture industry, so we should maybe think about, well, if there's a culture industry, then maybe we could also think about culture as a non-industrialized form, and what would that mean? And if you go back into the history of Western thought, then indeed what we find coming out of the ancient philosophy and ancient culture, indeed a totally different concept of culture. For instance, if you go back to Cicero, he was sort of like one of the first ones who was talking about the concept of culture. There were sort of like four broader ideas of culture, and basically it was identified with what you could maybe translate as cultivation, right? Culture meant, on the one hand, the cultivation, in a very simple way, the cultivation of gardening, right? So the first use of what culture and cultivation means is that you plant something outside, that you take the earth, that you transform the earth, that you structure and order the earth, and that you do farming and all these kind of things, right? But that's not meant, so to speak, as a destructive relational activity. Rather, it is meant to be to bring out what is potentially there, right? Cultivation has something to do with the highest possibilities that are there, and the cultivation leads to the outcoming of that, right? So you plant the earth, you do something with it, and what you have in the end is just flowers and the food and the potatoes and whatever you have, something like that. So then, of course, also culture had the sense of cultivation of things, right? To make things better, to refine things, to make them more complex, to make them more enjoyable, to make them more pleasurable, and in the end to make them more enjoyable and make them more pleasurable, because we as human beings somehow are part of that cultivation. And what we do is we cultivate ourselves, right? We flourish, we become better, we become complexer human beings through that process of culture. We are cultural beings because in the end we are sort of, that's at least the idea, we are cultivating ourselves through these kind of processes. And that, of course, combines both the cultivation of the body, the cultivation of our bodily activities, of our sensual awareness, of our sensitivity, of our of the world that we live in around us, and how we sort of are part with our body, with our senses, with our perception of part of that environment, and of course of our soul as well, right? The cultivation of our soul means that we all become some sort of flourishing, cultivated, more complex human beings. There are a couple of other aspects, I think I don't want to mention them all, because otherwise I will speak too long, which is always my tendency, but I think there are two things you could take into account. First, the refinement. Culture means refinement, and the second one, culture means perfection. So these are, of course, two ideas, namely through the refinement of ourselves, our abilities, our potentialities, of what we could be as human beings, right? We are, at the beginning, when we grow up and come out of mom's womb, we are pretty much nothing. But then what we have to do is we have to become our possibilities. We have to become human beings, and through what do we do that, if not through cultivating ourselves and the world we live in? And through that, there are two things that are possible, namely refinement. In my words and translation, it means sensitivity to what is going around you. And on the one hand, perfection. We want to perfect ourselves as human beings. And, of course, there are some other things. So now, if you just take that simple idea, right, of what culture actually means, and you compare it with the system that Horkheimer and Adorno are describing in the culture industry chapter, then you can, of course, right away see that their thesis is that we are living in a system in which actually the opposite is happening. Namely, we are no longer refining ourselves, right? We are no longer developing all the central abilities that we have and intellectual abilities that we have as human beings. But rather, what we do is we bring them almost to a standstill, almost to there's almost a destructive tendency through what is called culture industry in that chapter. So what was formerly called the cultivation of us as human beings is now taken up in our modern societies through an industrialized way of doing that cultivation, and no one should be surprised. It, of course, leads to a certain non-cultivation, to a certain dying out of that cultivation. And if you think about it, yes, why is that the case? If you just see, so to speak, the key terms that they are using in the chapter, it is very clear that when we are analyzing our cultural system, or through that system to which our refinement should happen, it is very repetitive, it is very instrumental, it is very commodified. It is very standardized. It is standardized in terms of audience reactions. It is standardized in terms of content. It is standardized in terms of genre. It is standardized in terms of what we are allowed to see and what we can produce and how it is produced and these kind of things. So there's a whole schema somehow that controls what kind of content actually we allowed and permitted and desire somehow to receive, in order then, of course, to become more flourishing human beings. And if you turn on the television in the evening, then I don't think that anyone wants to claim that actually there's anything helpful for our general human intellectual and sensual refinement there, right? So you just have to watch for 4 hours and you would say, yeah, that seems to be the opposite of that. Now, Adorno and Horkheimer, of course, saw that on a large scale. Namely, they saw it, so to speak, how we suddenly revolutionize our whole cultural system into a commodity system and into a full-fledged industrial form that does not allow for certain forms anymore. So there are other things, of course. The whole cultural system, for instance, the very central thesis has something to do with the affirmation of our life, right? It does not allow us anymore to sort of develop real alternatives to the system in which we are in. And maybe as a last kind of thing, it leads to a reduction of human language. And of course, as we know, it leads to sort of like a material or technological fetishism, right? If you think about the fact that a film like Avatar gets one of the highest prices in the US. Why does it get that? It gets it basically because there's a fetishism of technology in there, because there's not much content or not much to be talked about in the movie, except it was well done, right? So what we celebrate there is, of course, our own technological rationality. So that comes out throughout the film, but the possibilities of what it actually means to be intellectually engaged with something like a film is non-present, except that level. Now, in the last step, confront that with why we originally have culture and, of course, also a concept of art that sort of is contrasted to this kind of system in Adorno. You should also think about this somehow. Right? If you really think about the possibilities of artwork, and I don't mean by any artwork that sort of we have around us, but think about something like Beethoven's Ninth Symphony or Bach's music or T.S. Eliot's poetry. I'm happy that I don't have only German examples, right? So otherwise someone would criticize me for that. So something like that. If you think about it, how do we think about those kinds of achievements, let's put it that way, achievements of us as human beings, then we can certainly say they are non-instrumental, they're in contrast to our everyday life, they are not affirmative because they somehow break out of that kind of everyday cycle that we see every day in our everyday culture. They are very spontaneous, they are really a full-fledged, complex development of our imagination, which is not standardized and not schematized, which you can hear over and over again, and all the time you have the feeling that, so to speak, there's a new spontaneous element in there, right? If you think, for instance, about very central pieces of our musical tradition, it is very interesting that we can return to them again and again, and we find in them new aspects and new ways of listening, and somehow, although it seems to be repetitive, intrinsically, these, so to speak, high achievements are not repetitive in themselves. They're exceptional. They have a real promise of happiness and truth in them, whereas there's a very central point in the culture industry chapter in which that's a Freudian analysis, in which they have sort of like the claim that sort of we are living in a system in which we only have only that promise of happiness, but which constantly gets frustrated because never anything is given to us, right? I wanted to bring an example. If you open on Saturdays or Sundays the New York Times into the film advertisement thing, I mean, just look it open, right? 25 advertisement of the newest movies, and every time the repetitive claim, the new revolutionary super best movie of the year, and then the authority with three journalists having it backed up somehow, right? There's the constant promise of getting the best possible, and then you go into the AMC theater and only one thing happens, namely you're totally bored and you don't know what to talk about after the movie. But nevertheless, it was promised to be that new revolutionary exceptional experience that you have there, right? But there's no experience at all if you're really serious about it, because usually we go, of course, to the AMC theater to not have any experiences, but rather to forget ourselves there and have for 2 hours peace from lots talking about Adorno and IH classes and things like that. So then there's, of course, a commodity negation. So the classical idea of art that is behind Adorno and Horkheimer there has, of course, something to do in which artworks themselves are, of course, connected to material progress, to the modern period, also in some sense to technology, but in the end they are a negation of exchange and transfer and commodities and, so to speak, these capitalistic structures that we have there in the background. All right, so there are a couple of other things that I could go over. Why don't I leave it at that? Because otherwise, I have enough material for 3 days.
So. David has his job cut out for him. Do you want me to tell you what?
No.
Okay, just go ahead.
Well, I think it's great that Professor Lotz began with this historical contextualization of Adorno, because it's really important to know that background of who Adorno was, where he was coming from, and where he was actually located when he wrote these essays. So think of him as someone who escaped from Nazi Germany, was transplanted to the United States, and of all places, Southern California, right, in the Cold War period. If you notice a sort of ill temper, dyspeptic quality to his writing and his argument, I mean, he's been through a lot. He's experienced really the darkest, most evil chapters of human history, and so this is being reflected in his writing. So it's good to know where he's coming from. Now, I was put in the position of defending mass culture, and you know, as you can sense, this is not going to be a real classic debate, sort of firing back and forth, because I think all of us, we talk about this in advance, all of us agree with aspects of Adorno's diagnosis of contemporary culture, and all of us have some doubts and misgivings about it. But I'm going to try to bring up some other aspects of his argument, and point out some considerations when we talk about mass culture and think about mass culture that maybe Adorno is not attuned to. Well, it seems like there are two subjects of this panel. The first is mass culture. You know, mass culture, popular culture, namely, is it any good? Is it keeping us stupid, as the flyer wants us to think about? Maybe the second subject is Adorno and Adorno's argument, his critique of mass culture, and is it any good? And so I want to throw out the possibility that maybe Adorno is right about some things and wrong about others. So, for example, he may be wrong about mass culture or about popular culture, but he may be right about the culture industry. Or he may be right about certain forms of mass culture, but he may be wrong to generalize and say that, you know, all mass culture, all popular culture falls victim to these same tendencies that Professor Lotz has identified. I personally happen to think that he's right, and he's actually very prescient, very foresightful about the culture industry, and that looking at culture not as a bunch of isolated cultural producers and artists, but looking at it as a sort of integrated industry, a very powerful, economically integrated industry, really makes a lot of sense and helps explain the kind of culture that we're surrounded by. But I think he's very wrong about some of his examples. And so I want to start just by asking you a question about how you experience mass culture. How many people out there, how many of you consider yourselves fans of popular music and really, you know, pay attention to popular music? Just raise your hand if you consider yourselves, you know, pretty serious about it. Okay. How many people think that we have access to a pretty good supply of popular music? How many people are satisfied with the kind of musical culture that we get? Okay, so most of you who follow music basically think we're getting pretty decent culture. Okay, how many people out there consider themselves fairly serious movie buffs, you know, really into movies? Okay, how many of you think that we get a pretty good selection, pretty good choices in terms of films?
In East Lansing?
Yeah, okay. That's a good question. I guess within East Lansing, which extends as far as NKG, and of course the Wells Hall offerings, which, you know, are hard to beat. So many people feel that, you know, you get a pretty good selection of film.
Okay, it doesn't. Netflix.
Yeah, Netflix. Okay. And then finally, television. How many people think that what we get on television is pretty decent? Okay. So it seems like, you know, we're basically, as a group, those of you who sort of pay attention, who consider yourselves fans of particular forms of mass culture, are fairly happy, fairly satisfied with the kinds of offerings we get. Okay, which is something that Adorno would say, well, you know, he'd question, and that's maybe where he'd say, well, this culture industry is having this pernicious effect on our ability to, you know, discriminate about culture, to recognize what we're getting, and maybe we've all lost the ability to really recognize meaningful culture and meaningful art. I think whether or not you raised your hand as in terms of being basically satisfied with our cultural offerings, I think almost all of us would recognize that a lot of the culture that we get around us does tend to be homogenized, does tend to be standardized, formulaic, predictable. Okay, so I think we would recognize that as a sort of common syndrome that's sort of affected the world of mass culture that we live in. I think, and those are all tendencies that Adorno identified very clearly. I think we could also, or I would agree anyway, that a lot of this is caused by the commodification of culture. In other words, turning culture, turning art into a product that can be sold, that's sort of determined by market values. Okay, and we know how much popular culture has been commodified and sort of reduced to a marketplace item. And we can sort of imagine that that's maybe lowered the sort of common denominator of the culture. I think we can agree that advertising has become an enormous part of the experience of consuming culture and art, and for the most part, you know, maybe a negative, deleterious part of that experience. So those are areas where I think Adorno is really speaking to the contemporary situation and really identifying some tendencies that maybe were not as apparent in the 1940s, 1950s as they are now. Now, what are some? To take the debating position that, you know, Adorno is kind of full of it, or that his argument doesn't hold water very well. What are some of the critiques or some of the weaknesses? Well, you know, first of all, he does come across as quite ethnocentric, right? I mean, he's writing from the particular position of a German emigre, very highly educated, sort of culturally refined European, who basically has very, very high standards for culture and has a fairly narrow range, very narrow range of experience and familiarity with other forms of culture. So, you might notice the sort of references that he drops into his argument, and he is somewhat aware of contemporary Hollywood film, and he certainly includes some observations and examples that are recognizable, but. You know, as Professor Lotz said at the beginning, he doesn't really belong in that culture. Okay, so it's very alien to him, and it doesn't seem that he ever really makes an effort to step across that boundary and sort of experience popular culture from the point of view of someone who's closer to it. And why is that important? Well, he's making an argument where he needs to marshal some evidence, right, on behalf of his arguments. And I think some of his evidence just really doesn't hold up, okay? And for example, his commentaries about popular music, and in particular jazz, he's kind of infamous, Adorno is, for his comments about jazz music. This happens to be an area that I've studied, and it often comes up, you know, how could Adorno, you know, for all his brilliance, have gotten jazz so wrong, sort of missed the qualities of jazz that most other people pick up on. And, you know, I can provide some examples from the readings of where he gets jazz wrong, but it seems like he has a kind of blindness. And some people argue, well, he wasn't really referring to jazz when he used that term. He was referring to sort of, you know, bubblegum music, you know, very low quality popular music of sort of jingles, you know, radio jingles. And, you know, my response to that is, or the response that could be made is, if you're going to study and analyze and make broad claims about popular culture, you have to know more about it, right? You have to demonstrate that you know what you're talking about, I think, in a way that Adorno often really doesn't. One, he's talking about specific examples of this sort of low-grade cultural products that he thinks dominate the culture industry. Another big gap that or failure on the part of Adorno that has been pointed out over the succeeding decades since he wrote these essays is that he really tends to underestimate the agency of consumers of culture. He tends to underestimate the extent to which audiences really are not so passive, are not so easily deceived by cultural products, but that they actually see things in culture and draw meaning out of popular culture that's maybe more taking place at a more meaningful level than it would seem to Adorno. He seems to think that consumers of popular culture are really dupes and are not able to sort of notice or observe when they're being manipulated or taken in. And of course, you know, consumers of culture are quite savvy, and they're perfectly able to recognize when culture is when they're being sold a bill of goods along with mass culture. So ways in which his argument had been refined since the 1940s are by paying attention not so much to the culture industry and these products in isolation from the audience, but in looking at how audiences really create different sorts of meanings and more kinds of complex meanings in the encounter with mass culture. The final point I want to make is that things change. You know, so keep in mind, Adorno is writing a particular moment in history with a particular form of culture industry. Notice how dated his references are. I mean, he talks a lot about culture under Nazi Germany. Okay, he talks a lot about the sort of, you know, Charlie Chaplin and Greta Garbo and figures from, you know, generations ago. Think about how the culture industry has evolved since then. In some ways, it's more monolithic and powerful and all-consuming, much more so now than it was then. And so think about maybe how his argument can be refined, or maybe whether the sorts of questions he raises about culture are even more troubling now than they were back in the 1940s and 1950s. Second thing to consider is that Adorno himself changed, and his position was not static. And there's evidence that after he wrote these articles, that he came to adopt a more nuanced view of popular culture and less of a kind of monolithic view of how culture operated. And so by the end of his life, I think he died in 1969, he was more willing to entertain the possibility that culture could actually offer resistance, could offer negation of sort of dominant cultural values or dominant social values than he seemed to think in 1940. So I will stop at that point and hopefully take up some of these issues in the debate.
Hi, I'm Diane Mukoski. I'm a poet, and so probably I'll speak in a much more personal way than either of these distinguished gentlemen. In fact, I refuse to read Adorno until recently. And
last night?
No, you're a great mentor. What can I say? About 20 years ago, when one aspect of the culture industry in New York, that is the highbrow end of it, was what I call the Holocaust industry, and everybody had to be witnessing and talking about political disasters and stuff, which I, as a person who doesn't believe art and politics mix very well, was against, heard one of my friends say, what he said was a quotation from Theodor Adorno. After the Holocaust, how can we make art? And my response was, you idiot, that's exactly what we do in times like the Holocaust, is make art and somehow find ways to survive through our personal sense of possibility. Then Christian corrected me and said, well, you know, he took that back, right? He denied it. So I decided, well, this argument is really the argument that you have read and now I have read about the culture industry is what I've always believed, except I come from a generation of people who saw high art as one thing and comic books and popular music, not jazz, which was serious art, in another world. And those of us who participated in one world just didn't bother with the other. I didn't read comic books. I didn't go to the movies. I didn't listen to popular music until it became classic, like Bob Dylan or the Rolling Stones, you know, when they were old. And so I think that I have a lot of sympathy for Adorno's argument now that I'm thinking about it in different terms. And what it reminded me of is that what we're all against is what you were talking about, the commodification. What we all have to realize is that Adorno's context of Nazi Germany, it is parallel to the context we have today, which is the corporate culture that wants us all to think in a certain way. And there's no denying that anything that has to be sold to a lot of people has to in some way be marketed. I only watch television on DVD because I didn't grow up with TV and how can you stand segments, but I've watched all the available on DVD segments of Mad Men, which since I lived in New York City from 1960 to 1972, and Mad Men, Madison Avenue Men, starts in 1960, portrays New York exactly as I knew it. And I was married to a man in advertising. And I remember the excitement of the thought that somehow art could be used in a way that would make your job interesting. But what I brought today, and this is all I'm going to say, is Charles Olson, the great Black Mountain poet of the 20th century, writing his book-length poem in the tradition of Ezra Pound's cantos, the Maximus Poems, wrote in the very beginning of this, in the section I, Maximus, of Gloucester to You. I'm just going to excerpt some little bits. It's great lyric poetry, which has a polemic. His opening invocation against advertising. And let me just say that the theme of the Maximus poems is can be summed up in one translation of a Greek word, polis, city-state. And what Olson felt was that things have to be small and centered. And when they're small and centered, you don't have to commodify them or sell them. And that real culture from high to low has a connection, whether it's folk art or the motet composed by the monk or whatever. And that if you keep these communities with their integrity, you don't have to worry about this greater kind of mass commodification. And what advertising is about is destroying the polis, or the small, and making us all think the same thing. And in spite of my Dionysian way of looking at the world, it seems like it isn't really the community of the Dionysian. It's something that we all fear in the science fiction world of becoming, I don't know, clones. And in Olson's Maximus poems, he opens his argument by saying that there cannot be any poetry in a culture where the language has been so corrupted that words don't have precise meanings, or people, as Plato accused us all of poets doing, lie with their words to make us believe something. And so Olson says, but that which matters, that which insists, that which will last, that, O my people, where shall you find it? How? Where shall you listen when all has become billboards, when all, even silence, is spray-gunned? When even our bird, my roofs, cannot be heard, when even you, when sound itself is neoned in? And then in the next section he goes on to say, O Gloucester man, weave your birds and fingers new, your rooftops, clean shit upon racks, sunned on American braid with others like you, such extricable surface as fawn and oral, satyr, Lesbos vase. Oh, kill, 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 kill those who advertise you out. Charles Olson.
Okay, well, the question is about the impact of the internet and whether the internet maybe has the potential to maybe address some of Adorno's critiques of mass culture, maybe has the potential of creating a space for more meaningful culture. Is that a fair way of rephrasing? I mean, it's a big difference, certainly from the 40s and 50s. I would just say quickly that, you know, the internet has given us, I mean, Adorno was already saying, you know, we as consumers are sort of overwhelmed by what seems like consumer choice in terms of culture, and that people have access to so many forms of art and experience, and of course the internet has multiplied that by, you know, thousands or millions of times. So, I mean, we can feel that we're surrounded by this cultural artistic diversity. Yet, on the other hand, to what extent has that maybe enriched the experience, you know, our own cultural experience? I mean, do we have the potential to engage in meaningful ways with all that stuff that's out there on the internet? So, for example, now we have Netflix. We're not limited to the kind of films that we can see in Wells Hall or NCG, does that sort of sense of choice and multiplicity really equate to a richer sense of cultural experience? I mean, I think all of us maybe would answer that differently, but I think Adorno would be skeptical that just the mere fact of having more choice, you know, more objects for sale, more commodities floating around the cultural marketplace, means that culture is going to be any more meaningful.
Yeah, I think I would confirm that. I mean, the internet is a complex issue, but, I mean, on the first level, I mean, how would we look into the internet? We would first certainly look at it from a social point of view, so we would see which sense has that changed the way in which we are socially related to it with each other, and we could ask whether actually it has in any sense produced any form of more solidarity or has brought us more together. In a sense, there seems to be something very illusional about it, to think that sort of course, we have a great diversity, we have access to all these things that we didn't have access to, but it is not yet clear whether that really has in any sense the positive effect of changing our social relations with that extension of the offer. So I think probably Adorno also would rather analyze that as an extension of the marketplace into areas in which we didn't have it before. And if you think about it, I mean, the internet is not something that is sort of like any more connected to certain times of the day or a computer, but actually is happening that certain market forces are getting into our lectures, are getting into our breakfast, are getting into our iPhones, are getting into our earplugs. And so what is happening is actually rather that, so to speak, this whole market and exchange system that's connected to it is sort of like taking over rather our whole daily life instead of sort of like really making anything in a human sense more flourishing. Although I would not deny that, of course, certain possibilities are there, certain communications are much more efficient, but the problem is efficient communication.
I mean, just think about the way Google works, that it creates this kind of feedback loop so that your own preferences and tastes are constantly being refined and sort of fed back to you, right? So, I mean, in a way, your circle of experience and thought can be narrowed by the logarithms of something like Google and even the advertising. You know, you notice if you're using Gmail or something, you get that list of advertising. So, I mean, it's really easy to see the commodification creeping in even to the internet. But, I mean, to be fair to the cultural possibilities, I mean, how many of you are musicians or filmmakers? How many of you have ever made culture, say, for the internet in terms of MySpace, YouTube? I mean, you know, it does make it possible to think of yourself as a culture creator and actually reach an audience in ways that were never possible before. So I think, you know, it's clearly unleashed these forces of creativity, which are hard to dismiss as just being sort of, you know, marketplace effects. A lot of people are putting their work on the internet with really no sense of, you know, market benefits and market payoffs. And so, you know, that's not to be dismissed as well.
Nancy, I'd like to change the subject for a minute. I know that you gave us a list of things that were favorites of your students, and one of them is a film that I love, which is Fight Club, and Christian told me he hated it. So I want to hear Christian tell us how this fits in, and I hated is probably the wrong word. It's one of my words. But
oh my God.
Why don't you give us your cultural industry argument against Fight Club.
You should have told me in advance that you will ask me that.
Come on, I know.
How unfair.
You're always ready.
Well, I actually now I have to sort of remember.
why you said it.
I mean, I think one positive argument that was made for the film was sort of like this, that there was this Freudian idea there that through this aggression we can sort of like break out of these cultural systems, of the boring structures of our life, of the overdetermined culture in which we live in, and that we sort of have a certain way of going back to our what natural forces somehow, and that will liberate us. I mean, we would now need to watch the movie in detail, but as far as I remember, my impression was somehow that in the end it was really only a very weak structure, and in the end it was a certain form of celebrating a raw violence instead of sort of building up either meaningful form of violence. I had the feeling it was simply the celebration of, so to speak, getting out in order to return to something more brute in us, rather than, so to speak, what is the meaningfulness of how we want to get out and what are the possibilities of how we get out of this boring system in which these main actors found themselves in. So I think the main claim would be that I rather had the feeling it was an affirmation of violence rather than in any meaningful way taking up violence as maybe something that maybe should be critically viewed or can lead to something positive. There was no further following up somehow.
For me, the two things. The film was about how powerful our fantasy lives are and how important it is for us to live by them, that that is transformatory. And the other thing is, everybody who knows me knows I talk all the time about Apollonian and Dionysian imbalance in our culture and how the importance in our very Apollonian world of recognizing our Dionysian origins, the base of the pyramid, the physical world, that most of us have no connection with violence, gratuitous or meaningful. And for me, this film portrayed a man who was desperately trying to find that balance for himself. So both of those were powerful structures in the film for me. I don't know why the students listed it as a favorite, possibly very different reasons from anything that made you dislike it or made me care for it. I don't know if any of the students want
to
present
to tell us,
that. Yeah. It is true that many of you listed that as a favorite film.
Yeah, I remember, but yeah, I don't remember the word, because it was anonymous, it was the first day, and I don't
right.
know exactly how many people picked it. Wasn't their very favorite
was what?
Pulp Fiction.
Oh, Pulp Fiction.
Another violent one.
Yeah. No. Well, it was
But I don't think any of us hated Pulp Fiction, but Christian really saw some negative aspects of Fight Club. That was what interested me.
Other questions?
You must have other questions. Some argument or disagreement.
Well, could I make a... Well, you're thinking, and you're not off the hook, because we have 20 more minutes, but I wanted to pick up on something that Diane said really quickly when she was talking about existing, you know, sort of tuning out the world of pop culture and being able to exist in the world of, you know, quote-unquote high culture. And just to make another point against Adorno, which he doesn't really recognize that these cultural labels, cultural categories can fluctuate over time, you know, or that what is considered low culture in one generation can move up the scale and become high culture, and vice versa. And so, for example, you know, for Adorno, jazz represents this kind of low form of popular culture, sort of degraded, mindless, repetitive, robotic music. And we, in place of jazz music, you could put in, you know, rock and roll or hip hop or other things. But as we all know, jazz very quickly ascended up the scale, really about the time he was writing this, to be considered a form of high culture, you know. So, and you mentioned the Rolling Stones, and you know, Bob Dylan very quickly, I think, became recognized as someone who was not just a passing, you know, folk singer, but was a sort of great American artist. So it seems like Adorno is kind of frozen with these certain categories of, you know, high and low culture. Doesn't seem to recognize that these categories are much more fluid. And that's not really his main interest. I mean, his main interest is, I think, in diagnosing the culture industry and understand the impact of capitalism on culture and artistic experience. But still, to be a persuasive writer, I think he needs to be more attuned to how culture really does operate in people's lives.
Nobody
else has
questions.
Anybody else? Okay, there's a question. So, I think Adorno was not so much talking about crime and law, but really the industrialization of culture. It's kind of culture becoming an instrument. And then the dialectic enlightenment, that is led to power. And also, it seems like a kind of violence. So, I wonder, I'm thinking about the culture industry, if you would agree on the panel there, that, you know, it's not just that mass culture glorifies violence in many respects, plays with the energy of violence, but is it violent? I mean, could one, I think that's what Adorno was saying, is that in a destructive, even nihilistic way, the this culture operates violently on the people who experience it. Is there a kind of violence that's exercised against the audience in mass culture? Or is that sort of thing?
Okay. Yeah, the question is culture, is media culture of the sort that Adorno is concerned with intrinsically violent? Is it sort of, does it direct itself against the audience in a violent way?
I would confirm that. If by violence here you understand the limitation in which the intellectuality and the sensitivity of human beings gets diminished. If you understand that by violence, then I do think that it is, of course, in that sense, the schematization always goes along with that kind of violence, right? It limits us rather than let us unfold what is in us, so to speak. But I would confirm that, yes.
Of course, Adorno was saying that the culture and history of Nazi Germany was actually shaping the audience to accept the violence that the Nazis were perpetuating. And we live in a highly militarized society. Our customers of the culture industry accept a highly violent practice of or state. Is that, when you say that the inability to identify and react against the violence of your own world is itself the product of the damage done to the audience through the culture?
Yes, I think. Yeah, no, I also would agree with that. I mean, in that sense, of course, you could analyze our contemporary, probably rather media system than maybe the whole cultural system as one that's intimately somehow interwoven with some kind of affirmation of the contemporary political and industrialized and military system that we have. Yes. So in that sense, it is, of course, always in that sense affirmative of it, or the transportation of certain affirmative beliefs happens through that cultural system. That seems to be right, especially if we look into the evening television programs or the non-existing radio that we have, at least in the U.S., I mean, I think he would not take technology as something that is the product of the late 20th century, right? For someone like Adorno, technology essentially belongs, of course, to the process of civilization, because the progress that we try to bring about throughout the human process is always a specific process of technological development, which basically goes back to the development of our instrumental capacities. So that's not even a thesis that Adorno invented. There, for instance, Rousseau, French thinker, and they started out to think about what does it actually mean that we start out to progress throughout the process of civilization, and it seems to be that we cannot think that civilizatory process, that means our liberation from our natural roots and moving on, that is intimately tied to technological progress. So as such, I think we don't have to take the internet now into account as now the prime example of thinking about technology. So I think that starts much further to think about the place of technology. So, and that's why what I wanted to say earlier, I think the internet probably would be viewed as an a speeding up of certain processes, of multiplying certain effects, and of spreading the system even into in areas in which we wouldn't have expected it before, rather than seeing it as, so to speak, that new revolutionary thing that is out there and that now will finally lead to our human liberation because we can communicate with our Chinese friends in English.
Yeah, I mean, and I think in terms of the theme of technology and violence, I think we're all aware at how technology itself can be a vehicle for violence, you know, different sorts of violence against human beings, against the natural world. But just to get back to the question about violence and the media, it seems like there's different concerns about violence in mass culture. I mean, some people are concerned that people become more violent from being exposed to violence in the media, right? And especially children, very, very impressionable. They see people killing and maiming. They're more likely to grow up that way. But I think there's another sort of understanding of that, which is that people can be sort of numbed or that the media can have a kind of narcotic effect where they then tune out what's going on in the world around them, right? And they're sort of living happily in this media cocoon and even maybe surrounded by news from around the world, but it seems unreal, right? I mean, you know, earthquakes in Haiti and you know, bombings and so forth. I mean, it becomes a sort of background radiation, and therefore they're less able to sort of respond as citizens to that kind of violence. But as we were talking about that, I had a question. You know, I would love to know, how many of you have seen Inglourious Basterds? I'd love to know what Adorno would think about that. Christian,
have I haven't seen it.
Yeah, you should see that, because you know, I think it gets at some of these issues that we've just been talking about. And of course, it's set in Nazi Germany. It concerns the sort of place of culture, the culture industry of Nazi Germany, in a pretty interesting way. And so, what would he write or think about a film like that? Which I think, you know, it does sort of confront the audience with some difficult, some hard questions about culture and violence.
But I mean, I think sort of, I have the feeling we don't get really to the heart of the issues,
right,
somehow, right? So I do think we can, of course, imagine what Adorno have said about certain products, but
right.
He very seldom really talks about very specific examples. And I think there's a very simple criteria: as long as this cultural product allows us to intellectually engage with the product and what it intrinsically has to offer, as long as that is there, I think Adorno would not have any problems with it, as he could write hundreds of pages about Beckett, and he was also writing a book, for instance, with Hans Eisler about composing for film. So it was not the case. It's sort of like a misperception that Adorno would never have done anything in the media, or that he was just brutally negative about it. I think he saw positive possibilities of it. He had a high number of television appearances and radio appearances after the Second World War in Germany, one of the highest ones. And there's a famous interview series in which he talks about education after Auschwitz, in which actually he does not neglect the media as a way in which per se everything has to go wrong, right?
Yeah.
So I think as long as we would find examples in which that intellectual engagement would be possible as something that has intrinsically something to offer, not so to speak externally out of the function for us, what's the technology used, as long as that would be there, I think that would be absolutely fine with Adorno, and you would not have a problem with that. I think this the overall thesis has something to do with that. We are, of course, living with certain illusions, right? We believe that our sciences and our media system is enlightening us. We believe that it emancipates us. We believe that it leads to a certain freedom. We believe that we are, as individuals, are called forth by our cultural system. And through an analysis, we see actually, no, we are collected as a mass around the soap operas, and we are collected as a mass around CNN, and we are collected as a mass around Avatar, which in that sense does not allow us at all to have any form of individuality towards, for example, I can develop towards a certain poetry or whatever other examples that we might find. So there's a certain, what, ideology critique, of course, is built in somehow, and I think that's sort of like one of the points. I also would confirm that it's not really about the difference between high and low culture, right? There's of course this kind of claim out there, Adorno was this elitist, and the whole text is just the outcome of the elitist. But he gives tons of examples that refer actually to the so-called high culture, right? Like, he has a lot to say about the development and evolution of conductors in the 20th century and the standardization of classical music taste and those kind of issues. So I don't think that necessarily he says, well, there is the classical music and there's the low music and there is whatever, some very elaborate forms of making films and there the others, right? So somehow the text is here about this fine dialectic that if we want to find a way outside, we will probably only find it inside, somehow.
Kirk has a question. Do you still have a question?
Oh, yes. Yes. You've used high culture, low culture, pop culture, mass culture, and all of them. I'm just wondering, I'm interested as much as what students would think of what you might say, but, and that is, to what extent for students, the generation sitting in this room here, the distinction between high culture, low culture, mass culture, top culture even makes a difference. Could students here make the same choice that Diane made in the sense of I forget how you put it, but of not
watching TV, going to the opera or the symphony instead of
partaking in high culture. I'm wondering to what extent that distinction.
Well, that option is still there. I don't know whether people take it. I think people do.
But I may right. just so I think that of course I think I would of course support that. But I think Adorno would. Be more, Adorno's reaction would be more complex because he has criticized a lot of operas and he has criticized a lot of classical music as one that is not sufficient at all in terms of how we intellectual analyze it. So I think simply going to the opera, that might be good advice for our students, I agree with that, but it might overall not really hit, so to speak, Adorno's center.
So in one sense, if we're really trying to think of Adorno's dialectic, it's about how we experience culture, and when it becomes an industry, it's whether it's the opera that everyone sees broadcast on TV, not that everybody would watch it, but whether it's high, what I call high culture or low culture, it's how people use it. And in my old world, people didn't use pop culture at all. It was escape, it was entertainment. And my old definition of art was that the entertainment value is minimal. It's there for something that's more complex, which is not to say that you can't be entertained by it, but you in general have to be prepared to be entertained by it. You have to know more. You have to have more experiences to do it. Pop culture, what I call popular culture, aims at people who have no education, no set of criteria, no reason to watch it with complexity, but only watch it for its lowest, a common denominator of entertainment value. Mm-hmm. Right. So his dialect, in one sense, he shouldn't even bring in any specifics, because mm-hmm. his dialectic should be bigger. It should be able to apply to 1950 or whenever he's writing it, or 2050. But I think that one of the confusions for a person like me reading Adorno is that we do have specific examples, and then you start thinking, well, does he, you know, what does he like and why doesn't he like it? And our focus should really be on the whole idea of the industry, making an industry out of culture, which is the very thing that should be exempt from industry, should be somehow outside of it, should be so personal, so complex, so non-commodified.
But of course that happened, and you can commodify high art. That's the desire of every art gallery. I mean, look at pop art in the 1960s, where every rich person was fighting to spend more than $1 million for an Andy Warhol or whatever, and that was pure commodification.
Mm-hmm. And I also think that he would think about, you cannot think one without the other. That's why you called him a dialectical thinker, right?
Exactly.
If you think, for instance, about the development of symphonies, if to take his music examples, that, of course, is not possible without a technological advancement, a material progress, a certain commodified culture. If you think about the advancement that symphony orchestras have taken and what kind of capital you need in order, so to speak, to keep that going at the beginning of the 20th century. And I don't think that he would be necessarily arguing that there, so to speak, that outside is possible. I think that, I don't think that he would think about it, right? Is there, so to speak, a way of culturally going on to be in step outside of the whole system? I think he would rather think about these intrinsic possibilities, and it, of course, can still be the case that you can have very personal, individualized experiences even in that system. I think he does not deny that, right? I mean, Beckett was only possible because you had state-powered, million-run state theaters in Great Britain, right? So they were not be played in Frankfurt by his family in the basement or something like that. So I think he was aware of this kind of cultural force that's, of course, also in the background for those kind of things. But that does not diminish, so to speak, the intrinsic status of Beckett.
Do you think there's a moral argument involved also? For instance, the state supported, the Reich supported art, always had a propaganda value and some different sets of moralities, perhaps, than, say, the state-sponsored Beckett, which would have a very different set of values.
Well, that would be too rough to say that the state sponsored Beckett in that direct way. So I think that the distribution, at least in the Central European countries, is different than simply saying the state is sponsoring it. But he was very critical of the extreme left developments, Brecht, Russian art. So there's a lot of writing that actually goes against how art and culture was treated in the communist countries after the Second World War. So he was sort of like placing himself critically against, so to speak, both sides, a very traditionally German way of doing it, namely, on the one hand, so to speak, to get in distance to the American way of commercializing it, and also to get away from the communist way of commercializing certain cultural products. So I don't think that necessarily the problem is that something is state-supported or communal-supported. I mean, I don't think that there is any problem. The problem seems to start once that becomes, so to speak, politically used in certain ways.
And that could apply to religion as well. I mean, religiously used as well as politically used. So you go back to centuries where the church will only support certain art, which in one sense is political, but it's doctrinal also.
Right, but I think that would be very abstract view to look from now and to sort of be criticize the church developments in the 16th or 17th century. So I think he would rather have a historical view on that. So at some point it was necessary that these things were in, and then it develops further out of it somehow.
Class is over.
No, for me, you know, I just heard it. I could put it in